It's 8:14. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. This is the KPCW Local News Hour. The Utah Debate Commission will be hosting several debates this fall. On the phone to tell us about those and the mission of the Debate Commission, I have its director, Nina Sliding. Good morning to you, Nina.
Good morning, Leslie.
So if you would just start by telling us a little bit about the history of the Debate Commission. My understanding is Utah's lousy voter turnout rates jump-started this as a way to engage active political discourse.
That's right. In about 2013, a group of universities and media partners came together and determined really to enhance voter turnout and to engage Utah voters in the process that we needed to have a system of regular debates in the state of Utah. And this also put pressure on incumbents to debate when they have kind of shied away from debating. So the Debate Commission was organized and we've been in existence. Our first debate cycle was in 2014, and this will be our third debate cycle.
So do you get good turnout from the candidates now?
We do. We've had great success, and I think they have come to trust what we are doing and expect that there will be at least one debate held. And we're not the only show in town, so we encourage other organizations to still hold and host debates. And we only do statewide and federal offices. And so there are a lot of local city races that we do not hold debates for.
So this is also, tell us a little bit about who the commission is made up of.
So on our board, we have representatives from all of the eight major universities in the state, starting at Utah State in Logan and going down to Dixie State in St. George. We also have a representative from each of the major media partners in the state, as well as the two major newspapers. And then we have community leaders. We have Thomas Wright and Scott Howe serve as our chairs. And then we have community and business leaders on our board as well. So it's a great group of board members.
So it was a huge accomplishment to get the state's TV and radio stations to agree to carry these debates live and basically give up all of the profits from running the reruns of The Simpsons and Modern Family. So how did you do that?
It's true. You know, our board meetings are wonderful. We do a lot of debating at our board meetings because I think you bring together people who have been fiercely competitive and you bring them together for a common goal. And so we've really had great participation, great success with what we are doing. And everyone just wants to engage voters in this process and find ways to get them to turn out and to take an interest and participate.
But it had to be all of them. One wasn't going to, you know, to give it up, you know, and right, give up the profits.
Right.
It had to be all of them.
That's been the power of our organization, is they all firmly believe in this and they're all committed. So they have agreed to air it. Not all of them are able because of you have the World Series sometimes in October. Sometimes they have to preempt. But for the most part, most all of them air it on where our debates are held live from 6 to 7 p.m. And we have great buy-in from our media partners.
Okay. Now, does the commission take a stand on any of the issues?
No. We're just a platform. We invite candidates to participate, and then we just want to hold a civil exchange of ideas. And that's the whole purpose, is just to provide a nice platform and make these debates available to as many Utah voters as we possibly can. So not only do we have them on television, but radio, and then they're streamed live on Facebook, on most of our partners' websites. So we're just trying to make them as accessible to Utah voters as we possibly can. And this is a great service to the candidates as well, because it just allows them to reach as many voters at one time, whereas before it's been a little more sporadic in the amount of voters that they can reach.
Yeah. Any idea what the viewership and listenership is of the debates?
You know, a lot of our debates have been very highly rated as far as political events go, political shows go. They've been up there in the top ratings for a program in Utah. So we get a great response from viewers.
Recently, the Debate Commission completed some polling to determine which third-party candidates could participate in these debates. So why can't everybody participate? I mean, isn't that open political discourse?
You know, we would love to have everyone participate, but because we have just an hour and there are so many issues to cover, And our goal really is to give viewers access to viable candidates. And so this was a topic that was probably debated among board members more than anything else. But we had to establish a threshold, one where we could limit it to candidates who stood a reasonable chance of having success in November, and yet still allow enough time for those who wanted to gather as much public support. So we came up with a threshold of 10%. That's lower than the Commission on Presidential Debates. Theirs is at 15%. And then we also allowed for the margin of error in the poll. So, for instance, this year, our threshold is at 10%. The margin of error, 4% for the poll that we conducted. So any candidate who polled at 6% was able to participate. And this year we did have a third-party candidate, Eric Ellison, from the 1st Congressional District, qualified with 6.6%.
Wow. So how unusual is that to happen?
You know, last year when we had the special election for the 3rd Congressional District, Jim Bennett also qualified from the United Utah Party. So it's not unprecedented, and it just shows you what, you know, getting your name out there and getting some recognition will do. And so he was able to, both candidates have been able to participate. And like we said, we're thrilled when we have a third-party candidate be able to participate.
All right. So does that change the format then of that first congressional debate at all in terms of timing?
No, we'll still have the same format. We'll have a moderator and we'll have questions coming from panelists and from students. And then we also really encourage people to go to our website, which is utahdebatecommission.org, and submit a question. We'd love to hear from constituents, and it's an important time to get involved in this process. And so that's one way, is everyone can go to our website and submit a question and also request tickets to the debates. And like I said earlier, our debates are held from Logan to St. George, so everyone in the state should be able to attend a debate.
All right. Well, for our listeners' sake, I'm going to list on Tuesday, October 9th, we will be broadcasting from Southern Utah University in Cedar City, the debate between Senate candidates Jenny Wilson and Mitt Romney. Again, on Wednesday, October 17th, from Logan, the first congressional debate that's taking place at Utah State University, and then the third congressional debate coming from Utah Valley University in Orem, again, with the third congressional district seat. So you've got commitments then from all of those candidates then to show up?
We do. So it should be a good exchange of ideas.
Yeah. Can you give us an idea who's going to be moderating the Senate debate?
So Bruce Lindsay will be moderating the Senate debate for us. And he'll do a wonderful job. He moderated the Attorney General's debate for us in 2014. And then you also mentioned the first congressional debate up at Utah State. And Natalie Gochner will be moderating that debate. And then the third congressional debate that you mentioned will be held at Utah Valley University, and David Magleby will be moderating that debate for us.
Okay. He's out of BYU. Natalie Gochner, again, with what, the Chamber?
She's with the Chamber, and she's also the director of the Gardner Institute of Public Policy at the University of Utah.
All right. And Bruce Lindsay, of course, the former anchor and reporter on Channel KSL, yeah?
Right.
Oh, haven't seen him in a while. Interesting. Yeah. Okay. Anything else you want to tell us? I mean, just in terms of the format, they'll be giving opening sentences or statements, the moderator then just taking questions from those that have been submitted?
We changed the format just slightly. We'll just dive right into questions in our debate, and then we'll give candidates an opportunity for a closing statement. But I think the more questions we can get in from constituents, the better. So during the debate, we'll be fielding social media questions on Instagram and Facebook. So we'll encourage participation from audience members, and they'll have the opportunity to ask those questions real time. And like I said, you can go on our website also and submit a question to be asked of the candidates that night. So we want as much involvement and participation as possible.
Okay. Again, that's utahdebatecommission.com or org?
Org.
Okay. All right, Natalie, anything else you wanted to mention? Oh, I'm sorry, not Natalie.
No, that's it. Nina. Thank you for having me on the program, and we hope everyone will tune in or come and watch a debate.
Thank you, Nina. That's Nina Sliding. She's the Executive Director of the Utah Debate Commission. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. It's 824. KPCW News Time now, 8:25. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the local news hour on KPCW. Well, it's been a tough week for the city with the arrest of Assistant City Attorney Paulie Samuels McLean. Joining me now in the studio to talk about a little bit about that, as well as the agenda coming up on Thursday for the Park City Council. I have City Manager Diane Foster, along with Economic Development Manager Jonathan Weidenhammer. Good morning.
Morning.
Good morning.
So, Diane, let's just start with that. I realize that certainly this is a personnel issue, and you certainly can't talk about a lot. But in terms of Assistant City Attorney McLean, you know, assuming her normal duties, I mean, is that happening? Is she taking a leave of absence? Is she on vacation? Or
No. At this time, we have placed the employee on administrative leave with pay. And obviously, we will continue to evaluate her status as more information becomes available.
Sure. And city policies dictate what happens in circumstances like this. I mean, who oversees that? Is it you? Is it the city attorney?
It's a combination of the city attorney and myself.
Yeah.
And also in consultation with the assistant city manager.
Okay. And then in terms of just the timeline, we just kind of wait and see how the charges progress? Because at this point, I don't know that formal charges have been filed.
Sure. We're watching the review by the Salt Lake authorities, and we'll keep tuned to that. And as I mentioned, we will continue to evaluate the situation.
Okay. Anything else you want to say about that?
No. And thank you for that, Leslie. I appreciate your understanding.
Let's see. Work sessions kicking off at 5 o'clock. Council will be discussing amendments to the special event development codes. Jonathan, they'll be looking at really whether or not we should limit the number of new special events during peak season, along with allowing some smaller events there at the resort bases. So can you give us an overview of what's happening?
Sure. Big picture, I think it's important to remind people we're not looking for action or seeking changes to the code tomorrow. We have a public hearing, and we have draft red lines for everybody to see what we've learned. We've been doing a ton of community outreach with applicants and with the resorts and the business community. And as we try to kind of apply this new thing, we're learning individually for every different event that it's difficult, and trying to change the code is hard and affects everybody differently. And so we want to get some input tomorrow night and then really shoot for changes to the code on the 26th or 27th, whatever that Thursday is. But in general, yeah, we want to hardwire into the code that we're going to have caps on the number of big events. We're going to have shoot to target where we already have our biggest summer weekends and times to not have new events happen then. We're going to try to limit the amount of fee waivers. You know, we'll phase out fee waivers over like a 5-year process to try to get people off kind of the, you know, the free money thing. And I think it's a big change, right? 20 years ago, events was a huge priority for the city in bringing and rounding out the resort economy. We're a much more mature and successful economy now, and I think it's time for the city to maybe diminish its role and kind of the foot on the gas pedal as our other partners have become more successful, and really get back to balancing our community priorities that the city council has set and really highlighting them as the main filter for how we see and balance the event calendar. So it's not just economics all the time. It's really balancing some of our social and residential priorities.
Well, August 19th will go down in infamy as the weekend that we didn't have to do anything. So, I think people appreciated that. Maybe they didn't notice, but the traffic just was noticeable. So is that something we will continue?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the things we want to talk to council about a little bit is some alternatives. Jenny Dearson and her team have done such an amazing job mitigating for the impacts on events and really coordinating with our police and our transit folks and our parking folks. And I think we've done a heck of a job this past summer mitigating for the impacts of events, and we just want to check in with council and make sure we want to take all these steps, or ask them if you know there's just a few of the biggies that we want to take, like cap the total number of big events in town. But it is important to us to deregulate at the resorts. You know, the resorts are put on the face of this planet with the infrastructure and the parking and the staff and the bathrooms they all need, and you know, it's a perfectly good place to have more events. So at the same time we're putting some new restrictions on, we're also loosening the reins at the bases of resorts where we think that type of activity is appropriate.
Yeah. So when we talk about like events, the Deer Valley concerts, so that would be a free-for-all? I mean, they would...
No, it's not a free-for-all, but it's, you know, when you get to... We've now created 5 different stratifications of events. There used to be 3. And what we're trying to say is these small ones, ones and twos and even level threes, aren't a big deal. You don't have to come to us a whole lot of time in advance. It's a community thing at the city park. It doesn't have amplified music. That stuff's easy. That's a community event. We want you to do that. We want, because they typically revolve around small community celebrations and fundraisers. Once you start to get into the fours and fives, you've got a longer lead time where you have to apply. You have to make sure all your transportation and police stuff's in early. But at the resorts, the one, twos, and threes, they're not going to need a special event permit. The level fours, Deer Valley's or Park City's going to have to apply 90 days in advance, but they're probably not going to know who their talent is and maybe their exact date until like 30 or 45 days in advance. And we're trying to set up a process that can work through those nuances.
Okay. So the events that exist, the fours and the fives, I mean, that are, I guess, the threes as of now, are they grandfathered into this?
It's a great question. So we're trying to establish, I think, 12 or 13 times in the summer that grandfather's not the right word, but I can't think of a better one. So Arts Festival and 4th of July and Miner's Day, those are going to be kind of grandfathered. We're going to issue a calendar in February that says here's all the days, and there's not going to be any more events during those days. Now, with that said, we know it's not going to be a perfect process. It's going to take probably 1 or 2 years till that event calendar shakes out. We do have some conflicts already that we know about for certain summer dates, whether it's Triple Crown and the Extreme Cup or, you know, something like that. And we do have some existing contracts with some of the big events. Our policy has been clarified. We're clear on what I think our city council finds the balance to be, events that are more beneficial to the community and have a better balance than just economic events. And it's going to take a little bit of time to shake that out. We're working on locking down like a 3 to 5 year calendar looking forward so we avoid these conflicts.
Yeah. So when you say no more events, you're just talking no more fours and fives.
Right.
You would certainly allow the one, twos, and threes.
Well, the way the code's written right now, it doesn't allow any of the new events, but that's the first question we're going to be talking to council about. Did you really mean all the events, even the little tiny ones, no new ones? Or do you really just mean kind of those biggies that everyone's going to see and touch and maybe even feel the traffic or the noise or whatever? So we're gonna be clarifying that.
All right. So a public hearing tonight again, tomorrow night, and then again the following week. Or
We have a week off the following week, so it's that 27th.
That's the 27th,
yeah.
Right?
Well, we'll be looking for action on this stuff.
Yeah. So I mean, you think you're giving people enough time?
I think so. We feel pretty confident in the amount of outreach we've done. Again, we've had individual meetings with the event applicants. We've had individual meetings with the resorts, with reps from lodging, with the Historic Park City Alliance, with the chamber. And, you know, we've had really good input. You know, we've had event organizers that are local who have their trail race come in and say, hey, this process is going to penalize me if you don't let me apply early, get into the system, because I need to market and I need to know how much revenue is coming in and I need to have my books based on it. So we've tried to accommodate that process. And we've also, like I mentioned earlier, worked at the resorts to understand their constraints on, say, booking talent. So I feel like We've done a ton of outreach, but again, we didn't want to take action tonight intentionally so everybody could see kind of where those red lines are now. And we do seek individual feedback.
So are there events that are going away that we know of?
Not necessarily. Jenny would tell you if she were here that attrition takes care of some things. I think we've lost 5 or 7 events. Some of them are bigger. And some of them, as the calendar has tried to prioritize local and community, there's been some events that have just said, hey, we understand this isn't a great fit. So there have been some big ones, some that have gone away, Leslie, but nothing that's, not a Triple Crown or any huge one that you would notice right away.
All right. Diane, in regard to the Treasure Hill bond agenda item, nothing new here. City just following state code saying that you have to hold a public hearing to take comments on the potential issue of an open space bond. I mean, do we hold a public hearing between now and the election, or is it just this one?
It's just this one.
Okay. And again, a final opportunity then, if anybody's got something to say?
Correct.
All right. Any chance that the council could change any aspect of the bond language, or is that set in stone at this point?
I believe that is set in stone at this point, and that is what the council voted on the prior meeting.
All right. Also, staff recommending that the Park City Community Foundation be issued the convener contract in the amount of $100,000. Can you give us the details? I mean, how long is this contract for, and what do we get for the $100,000?
Sure, it's an annual contract, and for this, we get a community convener. And the idea there is that there are some things that government does very well, and there are other things that local government isn't going to be as adept at. And the city, in consultation with Kilo Zamora, who's a professor down at the U and who's very experienced in this area, the council has had a series of conversations about what's the appropriate role for the city. And one of the thoughts was, we have amazing nonprofits in town, ranging from the Christian Center to Peace House to the People's Health Clinic, and I can't even name them all because there are so many that are providing services to the community, and including the Park City Community Foundation. And the idea was, we believe that, and actually through feedback from a lot of community members, including a lot of community nonprofits, that there is an effort that needs to be done around what are the gaps in service, and how could things be enhanced. And, you know, you heard from the leadership class that looking at one nonprofit in Bozeman was an interesting idea. And I think the idea here is we don't want to collapse any nonprofits, but if we can provide through the city, basically providing ways to work better together. Now, there is a group, Park City Unidos, that is an amazing group, and it's very collaborative, and we want to enhance that effort. And so for $100,000, it does give them the ability to hire someone, and actually there'll be some existing staff as well as some supplemental staff. That's only $70,000. And if you think about that, what $70,000 is, that gives you between $45,000 and $50,000 for a person, which is a modest salary and is typical of what we see in the nonprofit community. There's also the ability to do, there's some research in there and some event money, as well as some outreach money in there. So that's where the $100,000 comes to.
Yeah, and back to your comment about the one nonprofit in Bozeman, and you don't want to collapse any. But in terms of having this convener, I mean, does that naturally kind of happen, do you think?
I don't believe so. I think the convener is a facilitator, not an owner. You know, so there's a very different role. And if you think about, for example, the work that's come out of the convening that was done by a combination of the school district, the county, the city, and also the work of the Park City Community Foundation, who acted as convener, that effort resulted in nonprofits coming up and of different groups doing different things. And so we want to work that.
So who will, once this contract is approved, then what will we see happen? I mean, immediately, or does it start the first of the year, or?
This contract will actually start ASAP, and there are some deliverables that will need to be done.
Okay.
And thanks to the wonders of minor technology, I do want to go back to one item. Nate Rockwood has texted Jonathan Weidenhammer and let him know that we do have an additional public hearing that is required by state law. So this isn't the last say. We'll have this one, and then we'll have another public hearing.
Okay.
Thanks, Nate.
finally, also, there is on the agenda a trail donation, basically Mountain Trails Foundation has built the trail and then has to donate it to you? That's interesting.
Yeah,
I mean, it's your property.
It's an interesting technicality that ranges from when someone wants to donate a bench on public property, or when someone wants to do something to public property, we have a formal process to go through. And what that means is that keeps us from just having someone donate something that the community might not want. So to be able to have that public hearing and have the community have an opportunity to weigh in, I think this is one of those, this one is likely more of a technicality. I don't know that you'll have people objecting to the wonderful work that's being done on Blood Lake to make that trail a better trail for people walking up to Blood's Lake, and I think a more interesting trail. And it's wonderful that there was a private party that came in and wanted to fund this.
It's a hiking-only trail. Do we know that?
I believe it's a hiking-only trail.
All right. And will it open before the snow flies?
I do not know the answer to that. I think it's pretty far along. I think they've been doing a lot of work, and I know that Logan Jones and Heinrich Dieters have been doing everything they can for trailheads, et cetera, and I know they applied yesterday for another permit with Wasatch County to do some more work. So they are doing everything they can before the snow flies.
Okay. And speaking of Bonanza Flat there, do we allow hunting in city limits?
We don't allow hunting in, for example, Round Valley. Now, that's not the city property. And actually, Jonathan and I had this conversation yesterday, and I forgot to follow up with Wendy. So I can get you more information on that as it refers to, as it in regards to Bonanza Flat.
Right. It's city-owned, but in Wasatch County, so their laws would dictate?
Normally, no.
I think as the property owner, we have the say in how it's used.
Okay.
And the one stipulation is that it is we are a public owner, and that can be a little bit different. And so I believe that the conservation easement, where you're preserving conservation values, there is actually a stipulation in there that allows a removal. Like, let's say you have an overgrowth of animals in that area that you can go in. But I believe the conservation easement in the future will prohibit hunting. However, the conservation easement is not on the property yet, so we may be in just an interesting middle time. But I will get the answer to that, and we'll get back to you.
Yeah, when does that happen?
We're looking for the conservation easement this fall. I don't think there's a specific date yet. We really appreciate the work that Wasatch County has done with the city. And in fact, we were nearly done on an enforcement agreement so that our police officers will be able to go up there and be able to do that legally. Usually you don't cross jurisdictions. And there's been quite great cooperation on that front. Wasatch County will still have a lot of the authority on prosecution. But basically we can get some manpower up there.
Okay. Diane and Jonathan, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. 8:43 now. Good morning. Well, raising resilient children amidst today's societal challenges is the topic of next week's Communities That Care speaker series. In the studio with details, I have the coordinator of Communities That Care, Mary Krista Smith. Good morning.
Good morning.
So this is happening when and where?
It is happening on Monday, September 17th at the Blair Education Center at the Park City Hospital from 6 to 8 p.m.
Okay. And you're bringing in a Dr. Brad Reedy. I know they'll be talking to him next hour on the mountain life, but he's the guest speaker. Can you just talk to us a little bit about who he is and why you brought him?
Certainly. So Dr. Reedy is an author. He is a local family therapist, and he's also founder of Evoke Family Therapy, and they run a wilderness program both in Bend, Oregon, and in St. George, Utah. And I was introduced to his work years ago when I read his book, The Journey of the Heroic Parent. And it really resonated with me and feels like a bright and fresh perspective on parenting. And I devoured every page, and it felt like a cool drink of water. So I'm excited to bring him to the community to share specific skills that we can all use as parents in this day and age where our kids are on technology all the time, and we have these new influences available like the dark web, and we just really need to better equip ourselves in this new era, and I've found his work to be incredibly helpful.
So what has it got to do with resiliency then?
I really like what Dr. Belknap from the school district shares about resiliency, and it's really preparing our children for the path rather than mowing down the path for our children. And it's about life happens. We have unexpected conflicts, difficulties in our life that we can't necessarily control, but the way in which we come to them with an openness to be curious, to learn and grow and expand, even in challenge, is the power of resiliency, that to take lemons and make lemonade, if you will, to take those challenges and grow and expand our capacity. And as a parent of a teenager, boy, am I learning all the time when things don't go according to my expectations or plans, how to learn and expand that capacity and really grow the relationship space with my child rather than collapsing into fear and control.
Okay. Well, and I think, you know, when I think of resiliency, I mean, children have more than anybody. So maybe this is really something for the parents as opposed to...
It is for the parents. And we, with Communities That Care, we did a very deep data analysis to see what are those risk factors that are present in our community. And one of those risk factors is parental attitudes. And that manifests itself in all kinds of ways. But when I ask the young people, the teenagers who I work with, what they think of that, they say, you know, our parents, we feel a lot of pressure to perform, to be excellent, to be overachievers and ahead of the curve. And they experience a lot of pressure and anxiety from that, along with whatever else is coming from society itself. When we look at the data and children report using alcohol, 70% of them tell us that they are drinking at home with their parents' permission. So we have attitudes within our community that I think from a really well-intentioned place are having an effect on the well-being of our kids. And what I appreciate about Dr. Reedy's work is that it is empowering to the parent themselves to see how they can most grow their capacity to create a safe and nurturing communicative environment within their home that helps kids deal with what's on offer in this society. We had the Frontline Blue Line event on Monday, for example, and there was an amazing speaker on the dark web, and this is completely new territory. 6 months ago, a year ago, I had no idea what this was, and we as parents need to be aware and equipped to support our kids. And so we could also see in that data with communities that care that we don't have a lot of resources for parents in the community. We've got a gazillion after-school clubs for kids. They can be involved in art and theater and sports. We have all kinds of mental health support for children. But when it comes to empowering parents with skills and awareness and understanding about how they can better serve their children and their families in this day and age, we really saw a gap there. And so bringing in Dr. Reedy is one of the ways we're seeking to fill that gap.
Okay. What else is Communities That Care working on? I mean, what are you going into year two now?
We are going into year two, and we are continuing our collaboration and coalition building. I think that the Frontline Blue Line event is a great example of that. And it's magical what happens in the space, Leslie, as all these leaders within the community gather together once a month and share with each other what they're working on. And you'll see, oh, I have a need here, and someone else has that resource, and let's work together rather than in silos, and it's powerful. And so we can see the expansion and the elevation of each other's work and collectively that prevention work in the community. We also recognize that to that gap of resources for parents, we are bringing in another program through Communities That Care called Guiding Good Choices. And it's evidence-based. It's been used around the country. And it empowers the parents and the families of kids who are at the end of elementary and moving into middle school about new styles of communication. You know how it is, Leslie, having had a child. The way I communicate with my 9-year-old is so different than the way I communicate with my 16-year-old. And there's a big shift that happens in adolescence. And we want to have influence in that space. And so this class, Guiding Good Choices, is really about empowering parents to have that supportive influence and also teaching the kids the risks of substance use, as well as how to say no to their peer pressure they may receive from friends and still keep that friendship. So we're excited. And that will be rolled out in early 2019.
Great. Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention?
I want to implore parents to come. It's not to be missed. You will be so grateful to attend this event, and you will leave with a fresh perspective. And there's something very powerful about coming together as parents and knowing that we have shared struggles and shared insights. And so I invite everyone to come. It's free Monday night on the 17th to the Blair Education Center, 6 to 8 p.m.
Okay. Mary Krista Smith, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you.
It's 8:51. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. Park City Summit County Arts Council has an event coming up called Art on the Trails. That's happening this Saturday, the 15th, in the studio. And to tell us more about that, I have Jocelyn Scudder, Director of Programs and Engagement with the Arts Council. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So this is happening Saturday. I mentioned when, where?
Sure, yeah. So the Arts Council is hosting the event this weekend. It's actually in partnership with Basin Rec and Copper Moose Farm, and it's called Art on the Trails. And so it's an unexpected creative experience on September 15th, this weekend, from 1 to 4 p.m., and it's on McLeod Creek Trail. So it's the trail between Copper Moose Farm Stand and Temple Har Shalom, right at that fork right off of 224. And so really, you know, we're looking for people to come and participate, or even people might even happen upon. This is an open trail. So But people who do come will be pleasantly surprised to find multiple pop-up creative experiences as they walk or run or bike down the trail. And guests will encounter dance and classical music, folk music, spoken word poetry, and more. And this is free and open to the public. All ages are welcome and encouraged to come. Our performers include Carlos MJ, who's a local musician, singer-songwriter. He'll be stationed at Copper Moose. And then we have Hector Ahumada. He is a spoken word poet from Chile. He actually lives locally. And then we have Kendall Fisher and Fiona Nelson, who'll be doing contemporary dance. Bill McGinnis, who'll be playing some folk music for us on the guitar. And finally, we also have a youth cello duet. So we'll be showcasing the young talents of Ellie Worthlin and Brighton Papik. So a great lineup for us. And just some location details. McLeod Creek Trail is a very flat, shaded gravel trail. So we wanted, you know, all levels of, you know, expertise with hiking to be able to participate. And the event will take place on approximately a 1 mile stretch of the trail between, again, Coppermouth Farm Stand and Temple Har Shalom. So it looks like we're going to have continued great weather through the weekend. So we encourage people to come, wear a sunscreen, wear a hat, comfortable walking shoes. And again, bikes are definitely welcome. And then just a small note, parking. We do ask people to park at the Willow Creek parking lot right by that dog pond off of Old Ranch Road. It's free, and we have permission from Basin Rec to do that.
Okay. So it sounds like you've got 5 stations set up, and they're going to be far enough apart that they're not going to be singing over.
Exactly. Yeah, and it'll all be unplugged, so there shouldn't be any noise pollution on either end. And they will be set off the trail, and sometimes you might even need to search for them a little bit. So it should be a really cool way for people to interact with performance. And, you know, of course, you know, in Park City, we love to blend art and nature. It's just such an important part of what we do. So we hope that people will enjoy it. And also, we will have refreshments and live entertainment, of course, but be sure to stop by Copper Moose Farm Stand. They will be open throughout the event. And so come and shop local produce, grab a bite. Carlos MJ will actually be playing right at Copper Moose. And there we're going to have information so you can learn more about the Arts Council and our Culture Club membership program who helped make this possible.
Okay. And in terms of you've got a promotion, are you basically taking it over, or is there a search committee for a new executive director to replace Hadley Dynack?
There is a search committee out for a new executive director. So yes, I have been promoted to director of programs and engagement. So I'm taking the lead on programs and marketing, events, and all of our community relationships. And then we are in the midst of a search for a new executive director who will take the lead of the organization, you know, focus on fundraising, all that good stuff.
What's the timeline on that? Do you know?
So applications for that position has closed. And actually, the board is working really, really hard on reviewing all of the applications. And it looks like they're doing a great job of narrowing it down. We had some incredible candidates. So fingers crossed, I think we're going to find someone really great to help us lead this organization.
Okay. And then in terms of the Project ABC, are we moving that forward at all?
Definitely, yes. That is in motion. Jake McIntyre, who is the lead consultant on that, we've received some funding to keep him on board, which is incredibly exciting. And so we're in implementation phase of Project ABC. So you can go to the website projectabcsc for summitcounty.org to find out, you know, look at the plan, see what initiatives we're moving forward. He's in the midst of doing a creative directory, which will be a huge asset for the community, and just working with different stakeholders that are interested in kind of implementing some of those findings through Project ABC. They're still doing steering committee meetings. I think they're hoping to go to a quarterly model with that. So momentum on that, and, you know, it's still very exciting.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention?
I just, you know, want to always throw out a huge thanks to our partners, Basin Rec and Copper Moose, for helping make this event possible. And many of you will be out actually enjoying Autumn Aloft that morning, which I will also hope to attend if I'm not too crazy setting up for this event. But, you know, we just encourage you to make it a full day by bringing your family and friends to the trail. And note that it's not a full, you know, you don't have to stay from 1 to 4. It's however much you want to interact. You can stay for 30 minutes, an hour, 2 hours, whatever you feel like. So if you want to find out more about this event, you can just visit pcscarts.org, and we have info right on our homepage.
Okay. And just so people know, if you were walking from, it would be a mile to the end and then a mile back?
Well, I think we didn't technically clock it. I actually did a site visit with some of the Basin Rec staff. I think it's about 3/4 of a mile. So it's probably a mile and a half loop.
All right. And
not too bad.
And it's flat.
Yeah, yeah, okay. Totally easy.
Okay. Jocelyn, thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much.
It's Jocelyn Scudder, again, the director of program and engagement for the Park City Summit County Arts Council. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW.